You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
The JSE has closed its doors for another day, so it's time for the 5 o'clock shadow. And tonight I'm talking to Viv Govender from Rand Swiss in Johannesburg. Now, Viv, we haven't spoken for a long time, but we've spoken on many occasions over the years, whether it be radio, television, and now a podcast. But I don't think I've ever seen a set of circumstances like we've got at the moment. We've been, you and I have both been through crashes and massive rallies, and they've sort of been influenced by one particular event. This time we've got a whole series of events all coming together over a period of a couple of years and conspiring against investors. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it in the 30 or 40 years I've been in the markets. Would you agree with me, or am I being too dramatic?
Yes, I suppose if you look at our life, you know, basically effectively starting, you know, late 80s, early 90s in terms of looking at the market, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And in that period of time, there's only been one kind of period that you would have felt would have been comparable to this particular period in terms of, you know, just volatility and whatnot. That was 2008. But you're right, 2008 was a singular, like, you know, driving force. It was the crash of the financial sector because of the stuff happening in the housing markets around in the developed world. And that was what actually drove that particular thing. There wasn't the crash of the housing sector plus the pandemic plus a possible nuclear war plus basically, you know, the rise of another power like China that's going through a massive housing crisis of its own that's separate from the rest of the world. So an event like what we're having right now, it's weird that we've had in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years. Effectively, I would count that probably from the start of the Donald Trump administration, not to say that he was the cause, but it's just a case of, like, you know, it appeared to be that's when the time started being a little different, because I remember the Obama years and they were like boring. They were like the Clinton years, you know what I mean? Kind of knew what the world looked like and what is going to happen. And you know, you could forecast 20 years in the future and thought, this is the kind of trend lines we're following. But from some of the Trump years till now, we've had a number of different things, like Trump, of course, and COVID and the invasion, and now the stuff happening in China and now Iran at the same time. It's just a conglomeration of things. And it's possible, as somebody once said to me, you know, when you have a bunch of perfect storms, it just could be a period of storms. You know what I mean? There could be just the fact that we are seeing certain factors coming into play right now that are going to cause these events. And when one ends, you'll see another one coming down the line. And one of the reasons behind this could be things, for instance, like the climate effects that are happening. And you could argue that climate effects have been playing a role, even in things like pandemics. Another factor that you have to consider is that we are going through one of the greatest demographic shifts probably in human history. The U.S. is in the midst of that boomer, basically the baby boomers from after World War II retiring. China right now is going through a massive drop off in its population as well, and by say 2050, 2060 could have less than 1 billion people. Europe as well is also going through that point where you're having a big drop off in the populations of these different countries, at least the working age populations of these different countries, because what you had was a lot of people in their 50s and 60s often having one or no children retiring. And in fact, Russia is also in the midst of a very deep demographic hole, and that could be one of the reasons that we are seeing this kind of global, you know, uncertainties, because this demographic situation is causing instability in what used to be quite stable institutions.
It's very interesting to you talk about demographics, because I did speak to somebody a couple of years ago, and this person had written a book about demography and said that if you're a really super long-term investor, then if you can understand the changing demographics of the world as an investor, then you can understand investing, because obviously there are certain people that buy stuff and there are certain people that save, etc. Like, I mean, the Japan example is a great one, where, you know, young people in Japan are not having children anymore. They're trying to encourage them to have children, but they don't. They'd rather sit and play video games. I know that's a sort of a frivolous example, but on the other hand, if you can understand the shifting demographic patterns, and as I said, as a super long-term investor, you would be well served, I think. And so, as you say, so many things are happening. And the other thing that you didn't mention as well was the shift to the right wing. And that always happens when there's times, like in the 1930s, for example, in Germany, when things are tough, people tend to just grab onto anything. And that is what has happened, not only in Sweden, which is a sort of a lesser example, but in Italy, I think it's quite a stark example of the rise of the right wing. And let's hope, please, that this doesn't become a trend elsewhere, Viv.
Look, it's definitely a trend that's already happening. And in fact, if you listen to Meloni talk here, again, it could be a demographic issue because Italy is one of those places that also has a decline in demography. And you are seeing, to a certain extent, to keep your economy functioning, when you have a declining workforce, what you have to do is import people effectively. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got to bring people in to actually replace your workforce that's getting out of thing, which causes this right-wing kind of situation. I mean, look at the right-wing parties everywhere in the world. What defines the right-wing right now is different from what it was in the past. Because in the past, the right-wing was mostly capitalist versus, communist, kind of no left versus right economically. Now it's basically, you look anywhere in the world, right-wing, some places it's more, government support. In Italy and Europe, it's more government support. In the U.S., it is more capitalist, etc. But they all are anti-immigrant. They all are looking at, a tax on the family. So look at Meloni. She talked about, I think her phrase is, I might get the order wrong, it's God, country, family.
Yeah.
Is what she's looking at, Donald Trump as well, make America great again, build a border wall. And what's happened in Sweden is also about, to a certain extent, immigration. And in fact, the weird thing is that there's only one developed country in the world that you can think of that does not have a right-wing pushback, and that is Japan, which has no immigration, effectively. And I think it is an immigration kind of issue that is really reflecting in what's happening in Europe and what's happening to America right now. But to a certain extent, they're doing the right thing because Japan is going to shrink as a population over the next, say, couple of decades. They won't have a workforce that's going to be comparable to what they have right now, let alone what they had in the past. And if they're not going to replace those people with new immigrants from offshore, you're going to find them shrinking into irrelevance as a country. And I think China faces the same kind of issue because they also have a massive demography and have no immigration coming in. Europe and America do have immigration coming in, causing problems in the short term, but I think long term is probably going to be the solution to their issues.
It's very interesting, isn't it? You just talked about Japan, and there's going to be this huge hole of productive people. When you look at Russia now, I saw a stat today, and I don't know if it's verifiable, but 98,000 men of working age have left Russia because of the draft. You see the queues at the border of Georgia, for example. That was it's an extreme example. But they're fleeing. They're not going to go back, not while Putin is in charge. So Russia suddenly loses a huge productive sector of the population. Essentially, what it is a brain drain. These people are sensible enough to say, I don't want to fight a war that I don't believe in. I don't want to kill people that are actually very close to us. So off I go. And they will be assimilated and absorbed into whichever country they choose to go to, should that country allow them to do so. In other words, someone like Finland, for example. But this whole migration worldwide is another big factor. But we're sort of getting off track here, or I'm allowing us to get off track here, Viv. But it is fascinating, isn't it? And you, as a fund manager, must be acutely aware of this, I think.
Yeah, before we get off the total demographic thing, we must mention the biggest demographic change that you're going to see in our lifetimes, the next 20, 30 years, effectively, of our working lifetimes. And that's going to be basically the rise of Africa. So by 2035, 2034, there'll be two new workers added to the workforce in Africa for every one worker added in the rest of the world combined, net worker, basically. So what you're going to find is over the next, say, 30, 40 years or so, the working population of the world is going to shift away from places like Asia, Europe, North America, and it's going to be concentrated more and more in Africa. And that is going to be where you're going to see either a boom or bust. I mean, when you have a lot of young people, you're either going to have them employed properly by having, jobs and industry and so on coming along with that, or you can have a disaster where you can have a lot of disaffected youth that are going to cause a lot of trouble going forward.
Exactly. So what you're saying is it's a double-edged sword. It's great to have this bulge of youth and a bulge of enthusiasm throughout Africa, and therefore if they do have jobs, then there'll be massive demand for fast-moving consumable goods and everything else. But if it doesn't go well, if the economies don't grow because of a world recession, then, as you say, a disaffected youth can cause a lot of problems. So it's a very, very fine line that we're treading in Africa.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And West Africa, look at the population forecast for places like Nigeria. Nigeria will have a larger population than current trends by 2100, but not basically in 70 years, in 2100, you know what I mean? Yeah. The way you phrase it nowadays, it's the start of the 22nd century, effectively. Then China. Nigeria will have a larger population than China by 2100. Can you imagine that? So it is a real big change in terms of the way the world is looking right now. But like I said, it has to come along with development. If it does not come along with development, it's going to be a disaster. So it's either boom or bust.
Okay, let's have a look at the boom or bust on the JSE today. It's stabilized a little bit. Let's have a look at company news. Pretty thin on the ground on the Stock Exchange News Service, Viv, apart from the Remgro numbers. Now, Remgro has disinvested from Grindrod. They came out with their numbers today. I think the share price last time I looked was up around 6.5%, something like that. Is Remgro a company that you look at Rand Swiss?
Yeah, look, I mean, the discount is growing, but growth is coming through quite nicely. I tend not to like, these conglomerates coming through because, you know, generally you do find that there is quite a big discount to like the other like valuation. And here, for instance, it's almost a 40% discount at the moment to the underlying valuation of the share. So that's quite a big differential. That being said, if there ever is a chance of splitting up, you're going to have a huge, you know, kick up coming through. It is something I do look at. Unfortunately, looking at what we are doing, what my global view at the moment is, I tend not to focus basically on Africa or Europe. I'm looking more at North America as my favorite place, so that's why it's not quite on my list at the moment.
Okay. Why are you staying in America? Simply because it's America, or simply because there are certain sectors of the American economy and the American corporate world that are just so superior to elsewhere, and I'm talking maybe about Silicon Valley. But what do you like about America, and why do you focus upon it?
Well, quite frankly, in a world that's uncertain, the only time that the U.S. dollar historically decreases, for those that don't know this, is when the world is growing in a stable fashion.
Yeah.
When the stability and peace in the world, the dollar decreases in value. Whenever there's uncertainty, whenever there's a disruption, the dollar gets stronger.
So it's a safe haven, in other words.
Yeah, it's a safe haven. And if you look at, for instance, in the 80s, I mean, we were both old enough to remember things like the debt jubilee and stuff, you know, to clean up debt from emerging markets at the end of the 20th century. And the reason for that was what happened was you had all these countries borrowing money, and then suddenly the dollar got stronger, and suddenly those dollar-denominated debts became a huge burden and caused, you know, economies around the world to crash. Whenever you have the kind of situation we're seeing right now, and in my mind, I'm kind of the analogy I'm using, and you always have to use analogies with a pinch of salt, yeah, is like the 1970s. Basically, you're talking about a inflation problem, you're talking about a commodity problem. Look at how badly the rest of the world did compared to the U.S. In the 80s. And I think that's something we'll be doing going forward. I think the U.S. is going to be a place that, because of its size, because of its reserve currency status, because of the fact it does not depend either for imports of food or energy on other countries or other regions that are outside its control, like places like China or, for instance, Europe, it is going to come out of this next, like, you know, few years relatively stronger than anywhere else in the world. And at the same time, you know, when we do have the rise of, like, for instance, these issues in, Europe, it's going to become a more and more attractive place for immigrants, and immigrants tend to be very, very great sources of, towards innovation and, you know, company formation, etc. So I do think the U.S. is going to not just maintain its dominance in the world, but I see increase it relatively over the next decade or so, just because of how badly the rest of the world is going to do.
Immigration is terribly important. I live in the Netherlands at the moment, Viv. I don't know if you knew that, but I've been exposed to somebody who's renovating a house. And the people that come along, you'll get a Dutch company coming along, and they are expensive. Let's put it kindly. They are expensive. Not excessively expensive, but expensive. And their timelines are a little bit expanded. Again, I'm being kind about it. In other words, they take a long time, and they charge more. A Syrian company came along. There's three Syrian chaps, one of which has been here for a long time. The other two have been here since the Assad oppression, and they're absolutely fantastic. They speak beautiful English, and they've learnt it very quickly, and they work hard, and they're honest, and they're decent. And I just think that any country that sort of is anti-immigration is shooting itself in the foot.
Yes, and look, it's at Africa at the moment. I agree to a certain extent on that. I think, look, immigration is obviously going to cause disruption. If you had the choice, you'd rather have, you know, the educated and the, what it's called, you know, professional classes immigrate to your country. You know, obviously, huge impact of that. But, you know, virtually every immigrant class you can think of, even those that come in undocumented, tend to have a positive impact on your economy if you look at the second and third generations down the line. And I think the U.S., by being the country it is, it's still unusual in the world. I mean, the one point I point out to people is that in the U.S., of the top four largest companies, right, which is basically the Amazon, the Microsoft, Google, and Apple, right?
Yeah.
Two of those four are run by immigrants from India.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Nadella at Google, or Alphabet, whatever you call it, and Microsoft, you know? Finch at Google and Nadella at Microsoft. But anyway, that is the kind of power the U.S. has. It's the fact that if you go to the U.S. and you have the talent, then you're going to rise to the top. And that is why it's so impressive. You know, we in South Africa, of course, know the example, not just of Elon Musk, but a number of different black players in like Silicon Valley, for instance, like Rolf Botha of South Africa. You know, there's even, you know, like if you look at some of the PayPal mafia, the number of people that have South African connections, even like Peter Thiel, you know, is from Namibia. That attraction, that ability to attract talent from South Africa, from India, from everywhere in the world, gives them that uplift. And so that's why I like the U.S. As well as geographically, it's insulated. It has huge, huge natural resources, which Europe may have the same population and the same kind of, you know, education levels, but they are vulnerable to things like, for instance, you know, like the current energy crisis.
And talking about Apple in India, Apple starts manufacturing the iPhone 14 in India. So they're migrating from China to India. And India will probably overtake China, both demographically and economically, in the next 10 years, I would imagine, Viv.
Demographically, the next 10 years, economically, probably not. India has some really, really dire issues of its own. Again, you mentioned the fact that people are not having kids. In the southern part of India, which is more developed, you tend to find, you know, like the places like Bangalore and stuff that you think of the IT sectors, those places actually have declining populations. It's the north that is poorer that has the increasing populations. And of course, you also have the social tensions happening in India around, you know, because the Modi government and Islam and so on. And so that's a danger there. You know, if I was looking forward, say, 10, 20 years in the future, and I would think where in like the world you'd find something really doing very well. I look at a place like Vietnam, Bangladesh. Bangladesh, by the way, has been incredibly successful. At one point in time, Bangladesh was the poor cousin for, it was East Pakistan, remember, back in the day?
Yes.
Before it split off from Pakistan. You know, until recently, it basically overtook not just Pakistan, but Pakistan by quite a bit, and even India. So it was like behind Sri Lanka as the most like prosperous place in the subcontinent. It has had some issues since then, but it's had an incredible rise, much faster than you would think. Also a really attractive place, and also a great source of labor, you know, going forward as well.
Okay, we've gone around the whole world actually. Well, half of the world, Viv. I mean, we're supposed to be talking about the JSE, but that's completely my fault. Let's have a look at some spot prices now. Here we go. I'll start with the currencies, where the dollar rand is 17.96, the British pound against the rand 19.36, that poor pound. The euro rand is 17.27. Euro dollar, gosh, look at this, another 0.75% fall for the euro. It's 96.15 at the moment, and when I say that, it means 0.9615 is what the number of cents that a euro will buy you. The British pound, yeah, it's recovered. It was 103.30 on Monday morning. It's now 107.75. Onto commodities. The gold price, $16.34, down $9 an ounce. Platinum is down 23 to $8.51. And palladium is up 83 for some extraordinary reason, 2,119. As for the oil markets, well, they're bouncing back. But they, as soon as they bounce back, they go back down again. Brent crude oil is nearly 3% higher, $86.44. Crude oil in the States, West Texas, $78.73, which is up 2 2/3%. Gasoline prices are now up 4%. That's not good for inflation. Jerome Powell will be looking at that one. What else have we got? Wheat up nearly 3%. Iron ore, that was down 1.5% this morning. But anyway, commodities getting a little bit of a boost today as world markets stabilise. US 10-year Treasury bond yield, now this is amazing, It wasn't that long ago. It was 2.52%. It's now 3.96%, a 7.5 basis point rise for the US 10-year. This is disturbing stuff. I mean, there are so many seismic shifts in the markets at the moment, as we've said in our introductions. What else have we got? The South African 10-year, not doing so badly. 10.78%, which is actually 9.5 basis points better, or rather down from yesterday. And the other one that I look at, because I'm obliged to do so, is Bitcoin, 20,135, which is up 5.2%. Those bond prices are really, really significant, because we haven't seen this sort of move for years. And if you look at the long, I don't know if you're a graphist, a chartist, but if you look at the super long-term bond graph of the US 10-year, it's broken out. It's been in a trend for 30 years or something to the downside. That's the yields, that is. It's suddenly breaking up, Viv, which is significant.
Yeah, it's 40 years. It's from the late 1980s, basically. From the late 1980s till now, every single uptick in 10-year yields in the U.S. has been lower than the last high. This is the first time that we've seen, in basically since the early 1980s, that a new rise has beaten the previous high that we saw. And that is the unusual part. That is the thing. And look, I mean, the bond market right now is in a real kind of turmoil. I don't know if you've seen the Japanese bond market and what they are doing at the moment.
No, tell us, please.
The Japanese are trying to, they're caught between a rock and a hard place, right? So the government basically is forced to keep interest rates really low, because Japan has, if you look at the world, debt here, Japan is by far the most indebted country in the world. Okay, it's smaller than the US debt, but it's a much smaller economy as well. But in terms of the GDP of the country, you'll find that Japan is just out of whack for everybody else in terms of that, which means that if government, the Japanese government was facing anything approaching a normal interest rate, the interest rate basically payments would be so gigantic that they'd be, crippling. So they are forced to keep, policy, keep the interest rates very low. They can't adjust interest rates higher, even though inflation is going up. And so what's happened is they have been forced to try and defend the currency, because the currency obviously is weakening over time. And they've been selling U.S. bonds, treasuries to basically try and match that up. But that's a losing game. I mean, you look at what happened in, for instance, Turkey. You can't fight the market, even if you're a country as large as Japan. So that's another disaster on the horizon, I think.
Okay. Yeah, turmoil everywhere. It's almost like if you're a meteorologist, it's two opposing forces, a high pressure system and a low pressure system coming together, and then there's chaos. So let's have a look at on my limited screen, I have to add, Viv, top five moves on the upside and the downside, ones that are noteworthy anyway. Sappi today, up 7.9%. Remgro up just about 7.6%. Harmony up 6.2%. Northam is a 5.4% gainer. African Rainbow Minerals 5.1% to the good. On the downside, I've got Italtal down nearly 5%. Hammerson down 4.8%. Investec PLC has lost 4.2%. And Naspers, after a good day yesterday, along with its sister or brother, Prosus, down 3.75%. Any other shares that have caught your eye today, please, Viv?
Not really. I mean, looking at that, I mean, with the Naspers story, I mean, nothing's been fluctuating with everything that's happening with Tencent.
Yeah.
And also with the currency as well. I mean, you've got to get that account. You mentioned before the palladium price, of course, talking about some of the platinum producers there. You know, Russia does produce, I think, around 40% of the world's palladium. And so that could be one of the reasons that we're seeing the palladium price be a bit more crazy than normal, with regards to that. So, yeah, I would be basically quite nervous looking at the commodity producers at the moment. One of the reasons behind that is that if you look what's happening right now in Europe, there's some serious government moves to affect the futures markets, especially in energy, but it might switch to other things, because they're talking about getting themselves insulated from some of these crazy moves globally. And so you might find that commodity markets going forward might not reflect the actual underlying market conditions just because of government intervention, which is a thing to be concerned about.
Can you give us the closing JSE indices, the ones that you refer to, the ones that you look at, please? And also, if you've got value traded, that would also be useful.
I do not have value traded at the moment, but I can tell you what's happened here. Despite basically yesterday's premature rise. The market ended the day up again positive. Yesterday we ended up positive near the end because what is happening in the US, the oil share was up 0.6%. The resource sector was up 1.4%, just 1.39%. Again, much of the move happened at the end of the day. The industrials were down 0.32%, and we saw the financial sector up 1.6%. I mean, that could possibly be linked as well to the fact that we are seeing the currency slightly stronger, breaking back below that 18 to the dollar level, which I think is a key level. Have we held above that for quite some time? It would have established a new bottom for the currency.
Generally a better day. I'm looking at the S&P 500 futures, 36.97, up 0.75%, but bear in mind it was about 1.4% higher, so it's almost halved its gains in the last 3 hours or so. Have you got the Dow Jones and the Nasdaq for me?
Just to mention on that, on the fact around the S&P 500, they've had trouble breaking through the 3700 level, and I think the only today we had that problem. Yeah. The Dow basically is slightly positive, up 0.2% here, and again, like I said, lower than they were earlier in the day, and the Nasdaq is up 0.8%, but again, they just broke above 11,000 briefly before finding, I think, resistance there, and that's now heading lower again. The unusual point about yesterday's S&P 500 is it ended the day lower with a down tick, which you normally don't see happen in the S&P. Normally, in a negative day, you see the S&P end up, slightly positive from the lows of the day in the last hour or so of trade.
Yeah, closed right on its lows, and I was very surprised to see it down over 1% yesterday. Fascinating stuff. Viv, thanks so much for your time this evening. It's great to talk to you again. Viv Govender is from Rand Swiss, and that was the 5 o'clock shadow. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.